CZSU, Stanford University. Welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm a resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School, and I thank you for tuning in today. Today, I'm very excited to have on the show the author of a very unusual book and a very interesting topic. The author is Julian DeBell, and his book is Play Money, or How I Quit My Day Job and Made Millions Trading Virtual Loot. This is a topic and an area that's relatively new in the sense that virtual worlds, as we know them today, have been around for quite a while, but their ability for people to lead what is called a second life, in fact, one of the virtual worlds is called Second Life, is quite remarkable. The days past where people could play games like Zork, the text adventure games where they assumed the character in purely text worlds and moved through mazes and tried to figure out puzzles, have advanced to the point where you have things like avatars, the graphical representation of you in an alternate world that exists purely on your computer, but allows you to interact with tens of thousands, perhaps hundreds of thousands, of people all over the globe. And from everything to communicating with each other by chatting to actually leading a life, it is possible in a virtual world to create an alternate universe for yourself where you assume a character that perhaps you wouldn't be, perhaps that character isn't human, you assume roles that you otherwise wouldn't have, and ultimately, in a virtual world, you can lead an existence that is independent of your existence in the quote-unquote real world. Julian has written a fascinating book where he actually embarked upon a project to test the ability to actually lead a career within a virtual world, hence the subtitle of the book, How I Quit My Day Job and Made Millions Trading Virtual Loot. And what Julian's book explores is not only the world of virtual worlds, but one person's complete delving into a very new environment where rules are only just now starting to be created, where norms are being created on a daily basis, and ultimately looking at how a person can enter this world and actually survive and make a career of it. And Julian has some very funny anecdotes about dealing with the and talking to IRS people with regard to how to declare his earnings in the virtual world, as well as coming across various and sordid characters in the world of things like gold farming, which we'll discuss, which is actually a separate entity, a separate world where people will focus on attempting to simply build up commodities in the virtual world and then sell them for real money. Although there's an alternate currency as well, to people that, just create goods to market them. And really, in a very interesting way, a lot of what goes on in the virtual worlds, mirror what happens in real life. And that ultimately is the question. How much of these virtual worlds ultimately become little more than extensions of our regular lives and what that means. So I'm very excited to have Julian on. Julian, interestingly, was a resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society in 2002-2003. He's written for numerous publications, from Details to Harper's to Rolling Stone to Village Voice. He's authored several books, and he's also very well known for an article in the Village Voice in the early 90s called A Rape in Cyberspace, which really took a look initially at and was one of the first articles to really take a look at how virtual worlds are mimicking and mirroring people's real lives. So I'm very excited to have Julian on today to discuss his book, Play Money, or How I Quit My Day Job and Made Millions Trading Virtual Loot. When we return from the music break, we will join Julian.
I've done my job correctly. On the other end of the line is Julian. Julian, are you there?
I'm here, Dave. Good to be here.
Terrific. Thank you for being here today on Hearsay Culture to discuss your great book. Let's start in, actually. I want to do a bit of a change from what I normally do, because virtual worlds are things that are so new and really a mystery to so many people. I thought before we even get into the why your book and what your book's about and the title and all those things, can you define in a crystallized fashion what a virtual world is?
Well, a virtual world is a, to me, it's a game. I mean, I was around for the first wave of virtual world hype, little remembered, little known, but in the early 90s, there was a lot of talk about virtual worlds and how they were going to create this parallel universe and you know, be the future of online interfaces. And I think what got lost in a lot of the metaphysics and futurology of that moment was the fact that almost all of these spaces that we call virtual worlds are games. Even Second Life, which is a very open-ended space where people can come in and basically build the world, that's what they do, and which the people that make it are eager to have not called a game, is basically a play space. I mean, it's a sandbox. And so the type of virtual worlds that we're talking about run from things like Second Life to, you know, at the other end of the spectrum, World of Warcraft, which is a game that a lot of people are familiar with. At this point, 8 million people on the planet are playing it. And in that, it's much clearer that you go in, you have a character, and you have a sort of ladder of progression for your character. You know, you start out, you're a level one newbie in this fantasy world.
A newbie is a euphemism for a new player.
Yeah. I don't know if it's a euphemism.
maybe not a euphemism, it's a nickname.
And you know, you see before you this you know, way to get better in the world, and you know, to go forth and slay monsters. You know, you start out slaying little rat beasts or whatever, and you know, you acquire experience points and you acquire items that help you kill bigger rat beasts, and then you know, your level goes up, and then you can kill bigger monsters so that you can get better weapons to kill even bigger monsters after that. It's kind of a treadmill of achievement. And that exists in a lot of, you know, computer games, video games, but it's kind of turbocharged in these online spaces because you're doing it in a social setting where you know other people can see what level you are. And you can see other people's levels. So there's a kind of competitive element, not a directly competitive, but competitive in the way that social status is in the real world. You know, you're always sort of drawn forward. You know, if you can be better, you want to be better. And so this ends up sucking people in and compelling them in ways that can be really surprising to people who have never played these games. And the ultimate surprise is that, you know, some people are so compelled to get ahead, and yet the things they want to achieve in these worlds, you know, whatever, the super dragon that they want to kill, or the ultimate, you know, dragon-slaying weapon that they want to acquire, are so hard in terms of the hours required to achieve them, that people will go, you know, to eBay or other, you know, online sites and say, maybe there's someone out there who already has this, what I want, what I need, and will sell it to me for real money.
And in that way, the virtual world start merging with the quote-unquote real world, and I'll use that term here for ease of the listeners. That's an excellent introduction, and thank you, because I certainly have found, just in discussing your book with people that aren't as into technology as you or I are, I have to really start from the beginning, because they say virtual world and it just doesn't compute.
Yeah.
Pardon the pun. So with that introduction, let's take a step back and get kind of the groundwork for your book. So the title itself is kind of self-evident: Play Money, or How I Quit My Day Job and Made Millions Trading Virtual Loot. Let me ask you this question. Why did you write the book, and how did you get into it? You talk a little bit in the book, but for the benefit of the listeners, how did you come to write a full-length book about this issue?
Well, I've been fascinated with virtual worlds my whole career. Right? My first, you know, the Rape in Cyberspace article was about a virtual world. The book that I wrote based on that was also about a virtual world. And so when I heard that these economies had started to develop, I wanted to write about it. I got an assignment from Wired magazine and wrote about the real estate market in Ultima Online, which is one of the earliest of the graphical multiplayer online games. And I ended up writing a story about, you know, one particular house in Ultima Online and how it got built and how it got sold to a third-party broker who made his living buying and selling houses in Ultima Online, castles, towers, whatever. And in the course of researching, of course, I decided, well, I needed to play this game to see how it works and so forth. And as people tend to do, I got hooked. You know, I got sucked into that treadmill and to that fact that, you know, there is a world in there, that when you turn it off, it doesn't go away. It's persistent. You know, that's the other key piece of the definition of these virtual worlds.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you get this sense that, you know, you can really make a difference in there. It's somewhat illusory, but you get that. It's addictive. And there I was, and this was during my fellowship now.
Mm-hmm.
A little warning to you, Dave. you know, which was both a blessing and a curse, because I had the time to spend, you know, I was doing 20 hours a week or so doing this game, but at the same time, I had this sense of, my God, you know, I have this year-long fellowship, I need to do something meaningful with it instead of playing this ridiculous game all the time. And so, you know, I suddenly had the, the genius inspiration that, if I could find some way, you know, to turn this into a research project, then I wouldn't have to quit the game. I could keep on playing.
Brilliant.
Now, that's the sort of cute, you know, version of the story. At the same time, I was completely fascinated by these economies and felt that though I had written this article, I hadn't really plumbed their depths. And I thought, you know, what better way to really examine them than to jump in?
Mm-hmm.
Participate and observe in the classic ethnographic tradition. And so I set myself this challenge, which I announced on a blog I created for the purpose, that I was going to attempt to, starting from scratch and from zero, to work up myself up to where I was sufficiently competent as a merchant of virtual stuff that I could make a living from it. And specifically, you know, to make a real game out of it, I said, well, I'm going to try to make on a monthly basis more than I've ever made as a professional writer hitherto. So that was the challenge, and I tracked it, you know, as the year went on and wrote about it online. In the end, I did not meet my goal.
Mm-hmm.
I in the final months, I turned a profit of $3,900, which annualized out was about a $47,000 a year salary, and I had determined that was not going to cut the mustard.
Right.
But though I lost that specific challenge, I must say that, you know, subsequently, I haven't done quite as well as a writer, and so, you know, maybe I should have stuck with it, but. You know, one of the things I learned was I'm a writer, not a businessman.
Well, and I think in writing this book and being able to merge these interests into the fellowship, it's clearly a useful use of the time, in my estimation. And obviously having a book that was published by Basic Books is certainly testimony to that. In doing this radio show, I also was thinking about ways that I could use the fellowship in a meaningful way, and I enjoy doing the interviews and educating and things like that. And so in both ways, I think the fellowship serves its purpose, given the broad title of the center is Center for Internet and Society. I do want to dive into a little bit about the fellowship and then get into some of the details of your book. But you mentioned something in your description of virtual worlds that I want to come back to for a moment, which is the idea that the world continues to operate even if you're not physically logged into it.
Right.
And because that obviously differs from the traditional video game that most people are familiar with, where, you know, whether it's Space Invaders from the beginning to virtually any game that you load onto your computer that doesn't access the internet. Again, for the benefit of people that have not used these virtual worlds, when you create a character, how does that character exist when you're not actually there typing in commands and moving the character about the world?
Well, it doesn't, right? And that's the source of a lot of people's anxiety.
Right.
You know, and the addictive quality of the thing. It's when you're not in there, nothing's being accomplished.
And other people and other avatars are doing their thing.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And getting ahead.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's very compelling on that level. At the same time, you know, it's not just that, you know, other random people are getting ahead. It's that, you know, you begin to create social ties in there, very intense relationships, particularly around the guilds that form in these games, you know, which are kind of like teams or clans of people who get together to try to achieve, you know, some of the most difficult goals in the game. And the politics and relationships that form and emerge in these guilds are as complex, you know, as anything you'll see in organizations anywhere. You know, the point where, you know, some executives in Silicon Valley are saying, look, I'd rather hire for a management position, you know, someone who's been running a World of Warcraft guild for the last 4 years than someone who's been in business school for the last however many years.
Because of the skill set that is created by doing that.
Uh-huh. Exactly. It's, you know, it's complex social relationships and interesting and attractive bonds to other people. And so that draws people back too. There's a sense sometimes of, gee, if I don't log in tonight for the big dungeon raid, you know, I'm letting my guildmates down, or geez, you know, that's just, you know, the most fulfilling social event in a person's life. And I don't say that disparagingly.
Right. You know, and that kind of leads me to the last kind of bedrock type question I'll ask before I want to get into some of the ideas that you develop in your book. What you described at the beginning, the spectrum from World of Warcraft to Second Life.
Right.
And both of these worlds, both of these games, if you will, do involve socializing. You're not, you know, your character, your avatar is operating independently in the sense that it can do its own things, but it can and does work in tandem with what other people are doing, either against you, for you, or parallel to you.
Right.
I'm curious, and then you have, aside from Second Life, you have things like There, .com, which is also another world along the lines of Second Life, and we've done some work at CIS in something called State of Play Academy, which I'm sure you're familiar with and know about, which involves teaching in a virtual world. My question is this: in terms of what would you define as if there's one major difference or a couple of major differences between the game environment of World of Warcraft, where you're casting spells and collecting weapons and gold farming and things like that, that we'll talk about in a moment, versus Second Life or There, where people seem to be, and correct me if I'm wrong, more involved in it from the standpoint of socializing and meeting people and less about collecting items. Perhaps if you could describe what you see as a couple of the major differences between these two poles, if you will, virtual worlds, that would be great.
Well, okay, so There and Second Life are sometimes called social worlds as opposed to the gaming worlds like World of Warcraft. So the social relationships do tend to come to the foreground in them. But I would say the real difference is, particularly in Second Life, which has a rich programming language built into it, that there it's not so much about collecting items as building items. You know, the real difference between World of Warcraft and Second Life is that the content of Second Life is largely user-created. There's just a rich range of objects that's been created in there, you know, vehicles, cars, and little mini-games that you can run around in and, you know, shoot up your buddies.
I love doing that. The paint gun is my favorite thing.
Yeah. you know, shopping malls that people have built and this whole fantasy world. And so, you know, what's interesting about Second Life is just its open-endedness along that dimension, you know, that the users themselves are creating the world rather than having it sort of handed to them by the game designers.
Mm-hmm. Let's turn into some of the themes that you develop in the book, and it kind of starts with what you just said, the idea that people are creating their world in the Second Life, their environment versus the World of Warcraft, where, as you discuss in your book, the designers may decide to put a rare item somewhere in the world, and you can hunt for it, and it accrues value that way. One of the themes that you have in the book, and it's a quote from your book, is the quote, "Production is melting into play," quote-unquote. And we see, from what I understand this term to mean, but I'd like you to talk about it a little bit, is things like Wikipedia and other sites show that the traditional rational man, rational person theories of economics aren't quite as applicable in the game social worlds, in the sense that people are creating, people are playing, people are existing in this world for reasons that perhaps wouldn't be the same motivations in, again, their real world, the life that they're actually leading as a human being. And we see also this issue developed in, and this idea developed in Benkler's book, Wealth of Networks.
Right.
What do you mean by the phrase, production is melting into play?
Well, Dave, I'm perfectly thrilled that you asked, because, you know, people pick up on that and they, you know, they just sort of gloss over it, and say, I'm just talking about, you know, these virtual worlds, and the fact that, you know, the play activity in all of these worlds, not just Second Life, but in World of Warcraft and EverQuest and all of them, the activity of the players is what's creating the wealth in these worlds. If the game designer puts a rare item somewhere in the world, it's still not going to come into the game economy. It's not going to become part of the wealth that has been created in that world as measured by eBay prices. And by economists like Edward Castronova, who did a famous paper in 2001, in which he calculated the GNP of EverQuest, right? I mean, he was able to say, well, we know what the value of all of these player-looted items, you know, these things that people go out and wrest from the wilderness of EverQuest, is by looking at the prices in the auction market. So we can then look at how much stuff people are acquiring in a given year and multiply that by their dollar prices and, you know, establish a gross domestic product or a video game. You know, and he's $135 million is what it was. So this is real wealth in economic terms that's being created by player labor. It's productive labor, and that's weird, and that's interesting, and sort of unprecedented, but it's not limited to these games. You know, my point about productivity melting into play, I was riffing on Marx's line about all that is solid melts into air, you know, which is he sort of very early on in the Communist Manifesto, in fact, isolated this element in the logic of capitalism that, you know, leads towards increasing abstraction of, you know, the world of production, virtualization, if you will. And so we see, you know, this trend leading, you know, all along the history of capitalism towards, you know, greater portability of, you know, you know, the rise of brands as opposed to actual products, intellectual property becoming increasingly important. But my point is that as that kicks in, then play has a way to enter into the economy as a productive force.
And when we say play, specifically, you're talking about actually interacting in this world. Is that what you mean by play, or are you talking about something different?
Well, I'm talking about, yeah, interacting with the world for the fun of it.
Oh, for the fun of it, okay.
If you will, right? I mean, I went into this world to make some money, but I could not have made money in there if there were not people out there, you know, in the wilderness of Ultima Online hunting dragons, you know, finding these, you know, rare items, bringing wealth into that world for the fun of it,
uh-huh.
for the play of it. And so it's very clear in these spaces that play can become productive in ways that, you know, the Puritans who got capitalism rolling, according to, you know, Max Weber's analysis of how the origins of capitalism and the Protestant work ethic, would never recognize. You know, play is not supposed to be part of the world of production. It's work that produces things, and work for, you know, for the idea of gain.
Mm-hmm.
But so it's very obvious in these worlds that play can become productive and sort of overturn that whole Protestant work ethic idea of where wealth comes from. But it's not just there, and your citing Benkler is a great connection, because I would argue that, you know, the open source movement, which has created all kinds of wealth, with nobody, you know, with the bulk of the energy and productive force coming from people who are not doing it for the money,
right?
And a lot, you know, so a lot of the analyses of, you know, why that is, talk about altruism, talk about political idealism, and so forth. But if you look at the hackers, the programmers, who are actually creating the code that is the wealth of the open source movement, the wealth of these networks that Benkler is talking about, their motivations are much closer to those of players. You know,
mm-hmm.
They are doing it. They're competing against other programmers. They want to be the one whose code is going to be included in the build. And then there's just the pure joy of solving the puzzle of the program itself.
Right.
It's a ludic energy, L-U-D-I-C,
mm-hmm.
the technical term. So that's what I mean, if that's enough of an answer.
No, I think it begs a lot of questions. We have to take a short music break, but I guess the one thing that I was thinking about as you were responding is of course one of the fundamental differences when we're talking about the play world and the real world is one's option to join the play world.
Right.
You know, people obviously, I mean, well, there are a few people in real life that actually have the option to not do anything. But for the vast majority of people, they have to produce. They have to do something in order to sustain their lives. Whereas it's obviously, at least at this point, we don't live in a world where you're required to interact at the level that we're describing in Second Life or There.com, which raises interesting questions that I think we can talk about the next music break, dealing with the why people are involved in the first place.
Sure.
And what it means, whether play in fact is mutating into a more pecuniary interest in involving just simply making money. We're talking to Julian DeBell, author of the book Play Money. You're listening to KZSU Stanford and Hearsay Culture. When we return from a short music break, we'll continue the conversation. Before we return with Julian, I do want to do what I normally do at the bottom of every hour, which is to, speaking of money, ask you for it. KZSU is a non-commercial radio station dedicated to playing all kinds of music, sports, and talk and news and other types of programming, and it relies on the support of listeners in order to keep its programming on the air. If you're interested in learning more about donating to KZSU, you can go to www.kzsu.stanford.edu and click on Donate to KZSU, or you can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, kzsu.stanford.edu. So feel free to do that if you so choose, whether
whether you want to send in virtual loot or regular money, and do please continue to keep listening to KZSU. So we're back with Julian, and Julian, before the music break, we were talking about this shift, potential shift between play and business, and I do want to follow up on that. One of the topics that we'll discuss in the remaining time that we have is the idea of the gold farm, and we can define that in a moment. But as more and more businesses, quote unquote, in traditional sense, begin to operate in virtual worlds, and indeed, as more and more people potentially embark upon a project, along the lines of yours, except with a very serious goal of sustaining themselves for an extended period of time, is it possible that the play aspect of virtual worlds you describe can in fact reverse itself?
Yeah, it's very easy for that to happen. I mean, once you decide this is how you're going to make your living, you know, all kinds of things kick in that kind of drain the play out of it, sense of obligation, sense of, you know, of necessity. And yet the weird thing about these games, which are so complex and so involved, is that a lot of those elements are already there. I mean, I talked about the people, you know, who feel like, geez, if I don't log in to, you know, help my guildmates, I'm letting them down. There's a sense of obligation there, of social constraint. So, in a way, yes, they can start to become less fun, but in a way, they're already about more than fun and in complex and sort of inseparable ways.
The world of the economics of the virtual worlds is something I do want to explore as well. And you also discuss the concept of inflation in virtual economies. You mentioned it a little bit earlier in our discussion when you talk about programmers putting particular rare items around a virtual world. But I want to ask you what factors you see contribute to inflation in the virtual world. And again, you know, turning to the motivations that people bring to the game, to the extent that people are actually living on these profits, does inflation as we think of it in the real economy truly exist in a virtual world?
Well, it does, in the sense that, you know, the basic economic definition of inflation being an expansion of the money supply sort of, you know, faster than the economy itself is expanding, right? So as a technical consideration, inflation exists in these worlds just as authentically as it does in the real world. It tends, however, not to be as problematic a phenomenon as in the real world. I mean, there are all kinds of institutions of, you know, finance that, you know, depend on there being not too much inflation in the real world, whereas in, you know, in the virtual world, in the game world, you're not as concerned about these secondary financial things, so you just kind of adjust. And as a seller, as someone who was committed to living off of these economies, you know, I learned early on that you just sort of factored in the inflation and dealt with it. You didn't want to sit on your gold pieces for too long because, you know, they were going to be worth, you know, considerably less within 2 months.
Uh-huh.
So, for all kinds of reasons that I can get into if you, you know, if you want to go down that rabbit hole.
I do, and would if we had a longer show.
Yeah.
And alas, I've belabored the fact that a 3-hour show would be too long. Maybe 90 minutes is the optimal. So I certainly would say that hopefully in the future, as we talk about some of the projects you're working on now, perhaps you can come back on the show and we can focus more specifically on the economics, the economic portion of it, because it does interest me. But I do want to move on to another area related to the economics, which is the idea of deletion of assets. You talk in the book about individual players who, for various reasons, had their accounts canceled by the masters that operate these worlds, which in a very significant way changes their lives. Certainly,
oh, yeah.
It ends their lives in these virtual worlds. the concept of deletion of assets is really one that in the real world only generally exists in theory. Of course, for example, when we talk about the federal debt in the United States, the idea that the United States would default on that debt, that those assets would be deleted, of course, would lead to the end of the world as we know it.
Right.
And certainly something that we don't want to see the deletion of United States assets ever be something that's possible. But I'm curious how, you know, in terms of, aside from the obvious impact on players, how does it impact a player returning to these worlds, and how prevalent is it that one's assets could suddenly be wiped out?
Well, if you're somebody who's doing the kind of gold farming that is, you know, outlawed in most of these worlds, you know, using robots or paying, you know, third world laborers to you know, farm your items for you, then it's a constant concern, because these items get deleted because the game company finds you out and cancels your account, and that's that. For the average player, you know, the bigger concern would be the hacker who, you know, fishes your password and gets in and sells off all your stuff on eBay before you know it. That's not a huge concern. That doesn't happen a lot. But the comparison is to deletion of assets is not to, you know, the federal government defaulting on its debts, but the federal government, the state government, doing all kinds of confiscations and takings that they do all the time. It's really more of a political act when somebody is busted for violating the rules. And it shows the extent to which the game companies, as sovereigns of these social spaces, are becoming more and more like real, you know, real world political governments. I mean, this is all visible in the kinds of politics people have about, oh, you know, you nerfed the warrior class in the last, you know, publish, and you know, you'll see the forums will erupt with outrage and protest. And, you know, you're really talking about different constituencies and different sets of interests being managed by, you know, a government. And that intensity of involvement that people have in their player class or whatever is just, you know, further heightened when there's real money at stake and attached to their virtual assets.
You know, it's interesting how, you know, as you talk, how one could conceive of U.S. constitutional law questions in the virtual world, because certainly, in one sense, what you're describing is, in fact, a taking, and it seems like a very clear taking, although we could get into the constitutional ramifications of what a taking means, because which is probably way off the topic of what we're discussing today, but suffice to say, there are various arguments you can make on whether it actually is a taking in terms of people's voluntary involvement in the world and what have you. But I want to return to the idea of comparing it to the debt issue, because I think, isn't it the case that were one's assets deleted, and you talk about it in the book, the deletion of those assets would have an impact on other players, in the sense that if a player has amassed a unique collection of items, and those items suddenly are gone, I guess the question is, what does it mean for the game? So I'll ask that question that way. If I'm a player and I have a rare item, an item that as you describe, the program is threw in there and there's only one or two of its existence, and my assets get deleted, I guess it's up ultimately to the programmers to decide whether they're going to reintroduce that particular item. So in that sense, it's really a control economy in that way. Am I reading that correctly?
Oh, that's right. Although that kind of rare item is a drop in the bucket kind of thing. Where it becomes like a real issue is where some of these gold farmers might discover a hack or something that, you know, they could suddenly double or triple the money supply overnight, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's great for some people who, you know, suddenly have access to what these guys are selling for really cheap. But, you know, it's not necessarily great for the overall economy.
Right.
And so when the game company goes in and deletes those farmers' accounts, they've suddenly shrunk the money supply back to you know, a more manageable size. And you see this going on in World of Warcraft now. The price of the Azerothian gold piece, the virtual currency of World of Warcraft, you know, doubled or tripled, you know, the exchange rate over the last 6 months as Blizzard, the company behind World of Warcraft, went in and busted a lot of these Chinese gold farmers' accounts. They really dried up the money supply.
Let's we've used the term farming quite a bit in the last few minutes, and this is an opportune time to delve into it more deeply. So for those, again, for those who aren't familiar with this world, what is a gold farmer, and how did, and we've kind of talked about it a little bit here, but what is a gold farmer, and what does it mean to be a gold farmer in a virtual world?
Well, farming in the general sense is any sort of just going out into the wilderness or into the mines of the world and just killing that monster or doing the quest over and over that gets you certain goods that have value in that world. In other words, even within the game, you can be focused on acquiring things to the expense of actually having fun. And what the gold farmers we're talking about do is then make a habit of that for the purpose of selling that stuff for real money. And what's come to be called gold farming has come to have a very narrow sense of particularly these factories, basically workshops or sweatshops, if you will, in third world countries where, you know, unskilled young people are being paid 25 cents an hour to play World of Warcraft or play EverQuest and acquire, you know, in that same hour that they're being paid 25 cents, a dollar's worth of loot or gold or whatever, that their employer can then turn around and flip on the international market.
Why, again, I mean, it's almost an obvious question, but why is that? Why, in your view, is that activity considered illegal or inappropriate?
It's an extremely complicated question. You know, a lot of players have the very simple view that, you know, hey, this real money trading, as it's called, RMT, where you can buy items in the game for real money, is cheating. You know, it's simply getting ahead, using money to get ahead where you should be able to just use your quote-unquote skills. That is a hard case to make when, in fact, the skills involved, such as they are all about just, like, spending the time to do certain quests and kill certain monsters. It's not really about skill. It's about investing time. And a lot of people just feel, you know, these are extremely complicated games with a lot of different styles of play, and a lot of people are not interested in doing those parts of the game that they find boring. So, and their buying stuff doesn't, you know, with real money, doesn't really get them ahead of other people in meaningful ways, except in sort of symbolic ways, you know. And so, that's the main thing, I think, is that a lot of players don't like it. And but obviously not all players, and not even clearly the majority of players, because a lot of players are actually participating in that economy. So, you know, and then behind that there are other issues. I mean, some game companies are nervous about, you know, a sort of appropriation of their intellectual property, and that's a tricky argument to make, because in fact there's no, this isn't like, you know, Napster, where people are making a zillion copies of, you know, something that they shouldn't be making copies of. It's one item, one copy is being traded from one person to another. So, and it's never leaving the server, really, that, you know, the company owns. So,
sorry.
It's weird and tricky, and, you know. And then there are the economic things where it can be argued that that professional gold farming, as opposed to, you know, amateur gold farming, exacerbates the inflationary aspects of these economies, and that that's a problem in lots of ways. But as we discussed, it's not necessarily the same kind of problem it is in the real world, and it's not necessarily the harms don't necessarily outweigh the benefits that this activity brings.
I understand we were discussing earlier that you're working on an article for the New York Times where you've actually seen some of these Chinese gold farms in action.
Yeah.
Describe those for the listeners in the couple of minutes we have left. What's your impression of them, and what have you learned?
Well, they're amazing. I mean, this is like Chinese labor conditions, so it's pretty harsh. These are 12-hour work days, 7 days a week, maybe one or two days off a month. And these guys are sitting there, playing World of Warcraft 12 hours a day. It's mind-boggling. And what's really insane is that when they're done, let me just say, so you look at this and you say, well, my God, this is, clearly this can't be fun. This is what we were talking about before. Doesn't the fun drain out of it once it becomes a job? Well, this is as jobby as this gets, right? These guys are punching a time clock every day and every night. And yet the weird thing is, a lot of them, when they're done, head out, in their one or two hours of leisure that they have per day, to the internet cafe nearby and go play World of Warcraft to unwind, play their own characters.
Unbelievable.
And so it's clear that, the fun hasn't been drained entirely out of their, psychic economy in terms of how they relate to this game. And even watching them doing their job, being paid for this, you could see that there was a kind of investment in, still they still wanted to beat that monster, and not just because, that's how they made their money, just that, they're, it's hard to let go of the fact that you're playing, even when it's your job.
When can we look for that article?
Well, I'm still finishing it, but sometime within the next month.
Terrific. Well, the last question I have is kind of the ultimate sum-up question. This has been a terrific discussion, discussing your book, Play Money, or How I Quit My Day Job and Made Millions Trading Virtual Loot. We always have a tendency, at least certainly I do, to view technology as all-encompassing, and sometimes we have to take a step back from it. And certainly I don't hear you suggesting in this conversation or indeed in the book that virtual worlds are going to take over the real world and, we're all doomed to a virtual existence. So I'm curious, in the remaining, in 1 minute perhaps, what's your view of the development of games and virtual worlds, and where do you think we're headed?
Well, yeah, it's hard to sum up, but I would say this. A lot of people have this vision of the metaverse, right, from Neal Stephenson's Snow Crash, this sort of alternate reality that's going to be the ultimate interface for the Internet, and, we're all going to spend a lot of time in there, have our jobs there, and all our financial and social investments in there. And it's going to replace, the shopping mall and all these other things. I think that could happen, but only if people remember that play is really important element in why people spend time in these virtual worlds.
Uh-huh.
When you create a virtual world that's just purely about chat and, creating little avatars and running around, people don't tend to hang out there. They hang out in the places where people have something to do, where something to do has been invented for them. And that if you try to, go straight to, we're going to recreate Walmart in these, we're going to build Walmart in Second Life, and it will be so much more fun to shop, virtually than in the real life, well, you need to rethink, where you're going with this.
Mm-hmm.
You need to think about what will be fun first, and try to create that game in there or that sense of play around whatever people are doing before you just try to graft the real world into them.
Well,
so it could be big, but only in the sense that play, as I've suggested, is becoming a greater and greater part of the economy, and the people that will win will be the ones who follow the play rather than the money.
And I think that's an appropriate motif, if you will, to end the conversation. Julian DeBell, author of the book Play Money, thank you for this fascinating conversation, for joining me on Hearsay Culture, and hopefully we'll be able to chat again soon.
It's been my pleasure.
REM Gardening at Night. I want to thank Julian DeBell, author of the book Play Money, for joining me on the show today. We ran out of time, but I did want to mention that Julian does have a website at www.juliandebell, and that's JulianDibbell.com, where you can learn more about the work that he's doing and take a look at other projects that he's involved in. It's really a fascinating area, and I've played around with Second Life and there, have had a lot of fun both shooting paint guns at my colleagues and also just exploring what people have created. So for those of you that haven't tried it, it certainly is interesting to do. I haven't played much World of Warcraft or Ultima Online or the other pure games. Maybe I should, although I probably will wind up, not only alienating, myself from, my new son who was born on February 1st, but also, my wife who will be saying, you know, the baby's crying and maybe you should stop, casting that spell and, get over here and help me, deal with that. So I'll probably hold off on World of Warcraft for now. You're listening to Hearsay Culture on KZSU. I do want to mention quickly, yet again that, my website for the show is finally live at hearsayculture.com. You can find audio for the show as well as links and things like that. The show, as always, will be and continues to be available on iTunes by searching Center for Internet and Society and Podcasts, as well as the podcast feed on the cyberlaw.stanford.edu website, the website for the Center for Internet and Society. So I encourage you to, as always, check those as well, where you can not only learn about Hearsay Culture, but also about all the great things that are going on at CIS. Before I sign off for today, I do want to mention that next week's guest will be a live show with Professor Mark Lemley, of Stanford Law School, who is a renowned expert in intellectual property law, and we're going to be talking about some of the issues going on right now in patent law and its impact on technology, and I'm very excited to have Mark on. He's a prolific writer and a wonderful person and guest, and so I'm very excited to have him here. And then the following week, I will be very pleased to have on David Brin, author of another great book called The Transparent Society. This show is actually being recorded on Valentine's Day, February 14th, 2007. I wish everyone a happy Valentine's Day. I do, of course, encourage you to continue listening to the wonderful programming on KZSU. And thank you again for joining me today on Hearsay Culture.